Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is Dan Sturm. Did I say that right?
That is correct,
Dan Sturm. I practice for like 30 seconds. Dan, tell the lovely people listening a little bit about yourself.
I am a director of video-related things. I have a company on the internet that makes commercial-type things. And I have a podcast also on the Incomparable Network called Defocused with Joe Steele.
That's right. The newest member of the Incomparable family, I think, at the time of this recording, Sam. So excited.
I suppose that is accurate, yeah.
Yeah, see? Who knows? Whenever you're listening to this, far future humans or aliens, I suppose. Although, don't take this as an indication of our civilization. There could be hundreds of more new shows on the Incomparable Network, but... at this moment in time, Defocused is the newest edition. So tell me, and the people who are listening, a little bit about Defocused, and then we'll start talk about Star Trek.
Defocused is a movie-related podcast. We just pick movies that we generally, at least one of us likes, and then we break them down sort of piece by piece and talk about what we like, what we don't like, what we think works. And both Joe and I have a little bit of a background in visual effects, so there is certainly... a little bit of a skew to the post-production. And, you know, since I do a lot of on-set stuff being a director, we sort of break down some of the technical aspects as well. But at the moment, we are working our way through all of the Star Wars movies on our way to the release of The Force Awakens. So that's interesting because I am not a space and sci-fi person in general. Like, I mean, I just don't have the history with it all, and Joe very much does. And it's mostly just me infuriating him.
Which is entertaining, I will say. Although I do question why you are going through the Star Wars movies when you have only done, I think, one Star Trek episode, Star Trek movie. I don't know. You may have done more than that, but
no, it was just the one, the one with the whales. And
the
stuff.
One, yeah, Star Trek 4.
Yeah,
as we call it.
It was good. It was good. I enjoyed it. It's just it's one of those things. I still can't explain to Joe properly with at least with regards to Star Wars how it just didn't really enter into my upbringing the way it did for other people, and I guess the same thing goes for Star Trek. It's just. It's one of those things I was always aware of. It's just I didn't participate or partake, I guess.
Well, that leads me to my first question, which I think you may have already answered. But would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
No. I mean, it's not that I like actively dislike it or anything. It's just that it was just never a thing for me. And I think I mentioned briefly to you before we did this whole thing that this is probably the first full episode of the television show I have ever watched. So,
of any of the television shows,
yeah, there's that because yeah, there are evidently many.
There are a few to choose from.
Yeah, so I think this is probably the first time I've watched an entire Star Trek episode of any sort. Which well, you know
that okay. This makes you the second guest on my podcast who has not seen any Star Trek episodes. Of the show before being on here. So I just want, let's talk about this a little bit because much like Joe, I'm playing Joe in this scenario, not that you've infuriated me. I just find it fascinating that someone can go through their life, up until this point without seeing a whole episode of Star Trek. Just because I think, well, obviously I'm surrounded at the moment by Star Trek paraphernalia. So for me, it's a big part of my growing up and it was always kind of there and I was actively into it. But it sounds like you were not. So how did this happen? You're not into science fiction, I assume.
Generally not. I mean, I think as, you know, a kid, everyone has some fascination with it in general, just, you know, space travel and all of the futuristic stuff. But, you know, I had the friends who were, huge fans. One in particular, I think he was both a Star Wars and Star Trek fanatic. And, you know, I would get... what I would consider to be a sufficient amount of secondhand Star Trek from him. So it was like, I was aware of it and I sort of understood, you know, you know who the characters are. You sort of know what the thing is. And that was about as far as my interest ran. I don't know. I guess I didn't even know where one would watch it. You know, I was more familiar with the existence of the original series. And, you know, it's just one of those things that I thought it was just in the past, and it's a thing people still watch, but maybe I didn't really realize it was still on in different incarnations for a while? I don't know.
So you've seen a couple of the movies, though. Which movies have you seen?
See, this is the part where people are going to start throwing things at me. I've seen the two, the new ones.
The J.J. Abrams ones.
Yeah, and Star Trek 4. Yeah.
And Star Trek 4, okay. Well, interesting. So what...
Interesting, he says with irritation.
No, I'm not irritated at all. I mean, you know, so things interest people and some things don't interest people. And Star Trek is a large interest of mine, right? But that doesn't mean that I think everybody should be interested in it. I can see how it might not get you, especially if you're not into that kind. It's a very particular kind of science fiction, which I think the J.J. Abrams movies, which I liked, are a different kind of science fiction. So I think more people have been exposed to the J.J. Abrams movies, and that's kind of their first major exposure to Star Trek, which I think is great. Although I then worry a little bit about people who then say, oh, I like the Star Trek, here's all this other Star Trek, let me watch it. And it's really nothing like the J.J. Abrams movies,
but yeah.
That's, you know, neither here nor there. So what did you think? So we watched an episode of Enterprise called Dear Doctor, Season 1, Episode 13, for people keeping track at home. And so Enterprise, just to give you some context about what Enterprise is set before the original series, much like the Star Wars prequels, right? It's filmed afterwards, obviously, but set before.
Hmm.
So it's a prequel. I don't know if you got that from this episode.
I did not.
Well, there you go. So it could be quite confusing. It follows, this is the first, I believe it's the first starship that is human crewed, and they're going off to find exciting new things and apparently, maybe cure a planet of its genetic, malady, although then decide not to for some reason. I'm still unclear about that, but, that's the crux of this episode. And then after this, so in the Star Trek chronology, after this comes the original series, and then there's The Next Generation, and then there's Deep Space Nine, and then there's Voyager, and then there is, we don't know what the new CBS series will be, but when it will be set in, but that's a little chronology. And then, of course, all the movies that you've seen feature variants of the original series crew, which are not in this movie at all, in this show at all.
So I guess that does help clarify the one part that sort of made me bang my head against the table, which would be the opening credits of Enterprise. It's sort of this, first of all, it's terrible, but it's got kind of like that time lapse of like the history of space travel culminating with the ship that we are now aboard.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that adds a little bit more context to that, but... that song and that montage of stock footage is... Ooh, boy, is that bad.
Yeah, I think it's the worst Star Trek opening of any series ever, mostly because of the song. I kind of like the montage, but the song ruins everything, so I can't even really like the montage all that much because every time I see the montage, I think of that song, and that song is awful.
It's not great, yeah.
No, and I will say, usually when I watch these episodes... I skip over the opening part because, you know, I've seen every opener of every series hundreds of times. I don't need to see it again. But I always give Enterprise crap for its opener, so I thought, this time, I'll watch it again just to make sure that it is still as bad as I think it is. The answer is yes.
This being set as a prequel to the original series, is that also the reason they made it look like it was made in the late 80s, early 90s? I mean, I see that this thing says 2002, but for part of it, I mean, maybe it was just partly the medical aspect of it. I felt like I was watching a Doogie Howser episode, especially because you've got, you know, the rampant voiceover with his dictated letter to the other doctor. And there was just so much that was just like... like after school special feeling with like the soft music and the discussion of ethics in voiceover as things unfold in front of us.
Enterprise, I don't know if that was a choice that they like a conscious choice that they made when they said let's create this show and make it not so great. Enterprise, of course, when Enterprise first premiered, Star Trek fans were super excited because it was a new Star Trek series, right? It was shot in HD. It was, you know, we were going to get this new show and perhaps we would get, you know, we're living in the golden age of television, although at that point it wasn't quite the golden age of television, I guess, but still it was modern television, right? Which was all the other series weren't really, you know, quote unquote modern. And then we got Enterprise and we thought, well, that's interesting.
Oh, I guess that is an interesting question. So this takes place, this is the prequel, but when was this actually released in relation to the other series?
So this is the last series that was on the air. So this was the, you know, this is the most recent Star Trek series.
Oh.
Exactly. And it doesn't feel like that. Like if you haven't seen any Deep Space Nine episodes, Deep Space Nine being another Star Trek series, which I feel like feels much more modern story-wise than Enterprise does. Of course, Enterprise is shot in HD. Deep Space Nine was not. So it looks older. But I would even argue that like the design and stuff looks better than Enterprise. Though, I will say Enterprise, given that they were a prequel, much like Star Wars prequels, whenever you decide, hey, let's set our story, show, movie, 100 years before this super famous thing... You give yourself a lot of trouble. It's a big challenge, I think. They designed it, I guess, to make it look kind of military-ish with little jumpsuits and there's lots of knobs and levers, so it kind of looks like maybe a submarine or something.
So would now be a good time to ask my question about why the sub-commander Vulcan lady is wearing like a sparkly unitard?
Because... I don't know if there's a real reason for that, other than she's an attractive lady, and so they put her on that unitard. It seems hard to believe that that would be the Vulcan. So she's a Vulcan officer. She has been. So the backstory of this, which they kind of mention at the end of this episode, is that so if you saw Star Trek: First Contact, which you didn't, but that's fine. The Vulcans make first contact with the humans and. They arrive and we become warp capable, so that means that we can become members of this great alliance of people who can travel the stars.
Oh, and, so the warp technology came from Vulcan?
Well, so no, a human invented our version of warp technology, and then they went off and tested it, and Vulcans just happened to be hanging out in the solar system, and they detected the warp signatures, and they came and said, hey...
Welcome to the party.
Exactly. We're here to be your advisors. And so basically the Vulcans decided that the humans weren't ready really to be major players in the universe. And so they were kind of keeping us down, man, watching us, giving us little bits of their information about they have this database with all kinds of information about other alien races and things that they won't fully share with the humans. They won't fully share their technology. So they're just kind of there. Helping out, being annoying.
So we're like the caveman who saw lightning strike a stick, and then we're running around with a stick that's on fire going, look what I got. And they're the more advanced people going, you should put that down before you hurt yourself.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
And that's what T'Pol is stationed on the Enterprise. She's a member of the crew, but she's also a member of the Vulcan Science Directive or something. I don't know.
She seems less than thrilled to be there in most instances. I don't know if that's her trying to like play up the emotionless Vulcan attitude, or if this has to do with the fact that this is early on in the timeline and she's just like coming to terms with the fact that she has to babysit a bunch of stupid people.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's an actorly choice, and also the character is annoyed that she's surrounded by idiots who don't know what they're doing. And yeah, she remarks often about how humans smell and how they have barbaric rituals and that kind of thing.
And yet... She's the one in denial about the fact that she may have a cavity on her teeth.
That is true. It seems illogical that she would deny the fact that she has a cavity. And even more so when it takes Dr. Phlox like 20 seconds to fix it. And she was like, no, I think I'll go. And he's like, meh, here, I'll point this thing at you and you'll be fixed. It was very strange. And so Dr. Phlox, we bring up Dr. Phlox because that brings up, he's the main character of this episode. The story centers around him.
Have we seen him before?
We have. He's a member of the crew, so he showed up and done stuff. I think this was every episode, every series of Star Trek needs a character that's kind of wacky and alien-ish. The man, you know, the man on the outside. This Enterprise has two. They have T'Pol, who is not wacky, but she's kind of the outsider. And they have Dr. Phlox, who is wacky and the outsider and super alien. And I think that was the big thing. I imagine, I don't want to speak for the writers, but I imagine they added Dr. Phlox because they felt like all of the aliens in all the other kind of Star Trek episodes that were regulars weren't that alien. And so they aliened up Dr. Phlox as much as they could, although keeping it within budget. So keeping just the face makeup, but let's make him have a lot of weird culture behind him.
Sure. So is this like maybe it could, is this his full first like full episode centered around him, or has he just always been like he's always there with enough context that we sort of knew these things about him? But I don't know. It just felt like this was his first like where most of the way through the season we can explore some of the other characters a little bit more and let's focus around this guy. Or am I just misreading that because that's what it felt like to me?
No, I think this is the first taste of kind of the Denoblian society, as we learn from Dr. Phlox, that, you know, he has three wives and they each of his three wives have three husbands, including him. And Denoblians don't like to be touched, which seems odd because the other thing we know about Denoblians, A, they have multiple spouses, which seems like there might be a lot of touching going on. They also, I don't know, maybe they don't like to be touched by non-Denoblians. I don't know. Also, they live in they have an incredibly high population, and we don't find this out in this episode, but in later episodes. And they don't like to be alone. They like having a big press of people around them. But maybe they just like being in the vicinity of a lot of people.
I was going to say, I didn't get that from Dr. Phlox in particular. He seemed to be relatively solitary, especially, I mean, he's got his little nondescript animal things that we don't really see in the opening there that he's feeding with you know, creepy alien stuff, including a worm that he, you know, one for you, one for me.
Exactly.
Kind of peculiar, but hey, he's an alien. He's gonna eat weird stuff, right?
Exactly. That's what they did that. And I wrote in my little notes, he eats a caterpillar. Oh my God. He's an alien. I think we see him eating twice. Once he eats a caterpillar and he's with his little creatures that he uses for medicinal purposes. And the other time he's talking about how hard it is to integrate with the human crew, and he's eating all alone at a table at the mess hall.
Oh, that was so sad. Like, I mean, I get what they were doing there, but that was very after school special about the, oh shucks, it's hard making friends. And like, he picks the worst person to like ask to sit down at lunch with. The guy is literally like running past him in the mess hall, and he's like, hey, I saved you a spot. He's like, I gotta go to work, man. Like, didn't you see me sprinting a second ago?
That's right. I just got a cup of coffee and now I gotta go. And Dr. Phlox is very sad.
Oh. Yeah. All by himself.
But he does have a maybe or maybe not love interest in this episode. What was it? Ensign Cutler? Is that her name?
Mm-hmm. Is it Crewman Cutler?
Crewman Cutler. Yes. She's not an ensign. I don't know
what
the difference is.
I'm not entirely sure what the nomenclature is.
I don't know what the difference between ensign and crewman is. I'm sure somebody listening to this knows and they could tell me. Why I should know. I don't know. But yeah, so Dr. Phlox is an interesting... He's actually, I should... Full confession. I don't really like Enterprise as a series all that much. I mean, it's still Star Trek, so I like it. My favorite character on Enterprise, without a doubt, is Dr. Phlox. And so that makes me... Spoiler alert. I kind of like this episode only because it's all about Dr. Phlox. I feel like it's heavy-handed, and there are a lot of stupid things in it, but I enjoy Dr. Phlox and the performance of Dr. Phlox, so that saves it for me.
He seems to be kind of the logical center of this particular episode, and I presumably more episodes. He's, you know, he's calm, he's rational, he has a broad, you know, he thinks things through on a much larger scale than you would imagine potentially a doctor aboard a starship would do. He just, you know, he's not there to just do his job and go home. He's thinking about the ethical ramifications of his work, especially considering that he is he has the more advanced technology, especially, you know, that's the whole plot of this particular episode. So mm-hmm. He's you know, he's the character that I guess you could kind of want to be like in this one, where he's smart and you know, he solves the problem, but he also uses his solution judiciously.
That's right. And he is, it's interesting. His character is interesting because he's kind of, you know, like on a, little, not a way mission. He's on a, I forget what they call it.
Doctor exchange program or something.
I was trying to think of the words exchange student, but it wasn't coming to me.
Doctors without solar borders or something.
That's right. So he's here. He's got his friend in Denoblia, who's a human, visiting there. I guess we should talk. That's the kind of the framing device of this episode. And why it's called Dear Doctor is that they, for some reason, dictate messages to one another, which seems inefficient, but whatever.
they're space pen pals. And then not only do they dictate messages to each other, apparently that gets like saved on like a little clear plastic card that they like mail to each other. Do they just upload that little card to like the Dropbox somewhere, or do they like literally fire that thing out in like a space torpedo that goes and lands at the space postal service or something?
I have to believe that he for some reason he saves it on this little diskette, this little, like, you know, future floppy disk. And then he gives it to Yoshi. Not Yoshi. Hoshi. Yoshi. That would be a weird crossover.
Where he grabs it with his tongue and then hops down the hall.
Exactly. Although, I would, you know, if the new writers of the new Star Trek series are listening, you might want to add Yoshi to the crew. That would be super cute.
I hear Nintendo's looking to expand a little bit. Maybe they can get into some, you know, cross-branding stuff.
That's right. I would buy a Yoshi amiibo in a little Starfleet uniform. So you get my whatever ridiculous amount of money you charge for those things.
That's already got to exist somewhere.
Right? It should. If it doesn't, it will after this episode. So he gives it to Hoshi, who is not a reptile or whatever the heck Yoshi is. She is, in fact, the comms officer of the Enterprise. And I guess she takes it somewhere and uploads it and transmits it. It's very unclear as to what. And I feel like that's the writers probably just wanted that interaction, so they wrote that. But also, the original series, if you watch it, you realize they predicted many great technological feats. They did not predict the rise of the computer network. So there's lots of people moving, you know, data around in little cards and, you know, because the computer can't send it to itself. So I'm assuming maybe they're keeping to that they don't have a network on the ship. I don't know. It's probably just the writers wanted to have Hoshi and the Doctor meet at the end again.
It worked.
I don't know. I guess maybe they're sending like podcasts to each other.
Basically, right? So we're doing the same thing.
That's right. Except we can talk to each other at the same time. You don't have to wait. That would be an interesting podcast. If I guess that's what the Green Brothers on the YouTube, didn't they start off by recording videos to one another and then responding? And now they have a huge thing that they do on the YouTube.
You should start a new show called Dear Scott, where we just send things back and forth to each other.
And then we will be millionaires and we can retire. It's a plan that cannot fail. So that's the device the Doctor is composing throughout this couple of days that they are on this planet, a message to his Doctor pen pal. And he doesn't want to write it, because I suppose if you're typing it, we wouldn't be able to hear what he is typing. So,
right, of course,
he talks out loud,
and it's all done mostly via voiceover, except for what, like that last little end bit where he's we actually see him dictating. But
he's all alone.
He apologizes frequently that it doesn't go out sooner because he's dealing with a thing, and then he elaborates on the thing, which is nice because we're watching and we need all of the exposition we can get, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So it's a clever, I mean, it's not like they came up with this idea on their own, much like, as you mentioned, Dookie Hauser used this to great effect, so.
It works. It totally works to help us get, like, into the story and to, you know, like, there's almost, it's not flashback, but we're, like, watching him, it's kind of flashback, because he's given the voiceover talking about how he's integrating in with the crew, and then we see him, like, go on one of his little doctor visits to a random burn victim who needs some ointment on his face, and we sort of watch him going about his business while we're hearing what it's like for him, and we get a feel for him pretty quickly. We understand, you know, that he's new here, and he's studying the humans. He thinks it's fascinating, and then we get a little bit more of it when he has some actual conversations. But it's all very Dr. Phlox centric, which is good. Although that one conversation with, I totally forget who he's having lunch with, where they're doing it in his native language.
Oh,
and
Hoshi.
She keeps accidentally saying the wrong word. Like, okay, that gag is fun, like once, twice maybe, but then repeatedly over and over again. I think the word you're looking for is, or what did you call me?
Yeah, I think they did that maybe, what, three or four times where she an eggplant is a nostril, I think it's the first one, and then you think, oh, that's cute. And then she says, oh, you two make a cute washboard, and you're like, okay, enough with that. And then she does it again, and you're like, oh, stop, Hoshi.
The writers are like, guys, we got to fill 44 minutes of this thing, so let's do it a couple more times. Although, you know, again, the characters are not, like, idiotic, so it's fine to watch.
Right. She's not like... every word is wrong, and she's clearly learning a very complex language, so it's understandable that perhaps she could make these mistakes. But I think the writers must have thought it was hilarious.
Well, it looks great on paper.
Exactly. It was fine. I did like I always find this perplexing, but I did like this scene where, for some reason, on the Enterprise, they have a movie night, which I can understand.
Oh, my God.
But they choose to watch... I forget how many, they're maybe a couple hundred years ahead of us, and they're watching a movie that's old for us. I don't even know what movie it is. I'm sure it's some famous movie, and I'm probably supposed to know what it is, but I don't.
Royalty-free black and white movie from the 20s or something.
Exactly. And so they're all gathered in the mess hall watching this super old movie. And I never really understood why they would do that 200 years in the future. I would think that they would have other movies that they could watch that perhaps would be more culturally relevant to them.
It's a classic, and Dr. Phlox is both fascinated, but primarily because everyone is having such a dramatic emotional response, and he's mostly staring at them. And then was it Cutler who was sitting next to him who said, yep, like, you look bored, we can leave. He's like, no, this is cool. I'm staring at all the people, and people are literally crying while watching this movie. Well, while they're watching the blue screen that is horribly, horribly, horribly keyed in, but that's fine.
It was a different time.
It was a different time. It was 2002. We didn't understand how blue screens worked.
That's right. It was new technology. Even though
they were invented around the same time as that movie that they were watching was made.
I assume that movie is a Paramount movie of some kind, maybe, and they could just use it for free. But I don't know. But they do that a couple times. I don't understand it. But I did like it just because Phlox was like, well, Cutler was like, oh, you're bored. Don't you have movies on your planet? And he said, well, we did a couple hundred years ago, but then we figured our own lives were much more interesting, so it never really got off the ground.
I mean, with the whole three wives, six husbands thing or whatever they got going on there, like that would be far more interesting and dramatic than watching a movie like this.
It's true. The little hints of what life is like on Denoblia that we get in this episode does make it seem like an interesting place. He suggests that his friend go to some kind of cave bar or something like that, but he tells him not to go alone because it could be quite overwhelming the first time you go.
Sure.
And then that leads you to think what could possibly be going on at this alien bar. So they did just enough to, you know, elicit some, you know, pique your interest, but they didn't, you know, belabor the point by saying, oh, you better wear your lead underpants or something. I don't know why they would do
yeah,
that.
The nice subtext of this whole thing is different races are different. Isn't that wacky?
Exactly. Isn't it cute? And so that's we even have not even gotten to the main dilemma, I suppose, of this episode, which is the Enterprise comes across a pre-warp vessel. They beam the people. They don't beam them aboard. They put it in their cargo bay, which is always a bad idea. No Star Trek episodes would be written if they couldn't do stupid things like randomly just pick up random spaceships and put them on their own spaceship without really doing any investigation.
Especially with sick people on board, because that could never go wrong, right?
That's right. So it turns out they have two people are in there, and they're both dying of some weird plague that their planet has, that apparently one in three people on their planet is suffering from the same malady.
It's an epidemic.
It is an epidemic. And so, of course, Captain Archer says, well, we're going to go help you, by golly. And so they go off to, I forget even the name of the Velaskans?
Velakian?
Velakians, there you go. So they go to Velakia, I guess is the name of their planet. And they you know, tour a hospital set.
Sure.
As you do.
They speak to the local doctor and, you know, I offer to help them out with all of their advanced technology, which is very kind of them to do. Although, yes, you know, the underlying premise in this is, I guess, you know, I briefly looked into this. The pre-warp is kind of a known thing for certain, mm-hmm, cultures in Star Trek. And for a less advanced culture, they all seem very rational and very understanding of their position in the universe and the food chain, I guess. Like they understand that they are less advanced, which just that sort of understanding would lead you to think that they are more advanced than they are, which is kind of confusing because, you know, they understand all of the space politics, which you think they would be slightly more outraged at the fact that, you know, there are certain things that they can and cannot do.
Well, they did. They were visited by two other warp-capable races, apparently, in the past. So one I'd never heard of, and then the other is the Ferengi, which are a well-known race of Star Trek people that are basically traders, and, you know, they're crazy about making profit. So one imagines they've been exposed to that kind of thing, so they are not surprised that there are other warp-capable folks out there. And really what they wanted, for some reason, was a warp-capable ship, because they figured somehow that would help them figure out this disease. I didn't really get the reasoning behind that.
Well, it's so they could explore further distances and find people who are able and willing to help them, which is fine, I guess. I mean, that worked sort of as a plot device, although, I don't know, I guess they were just turned down by the other warp-capable society?
Yeah, you probably are not familiar with the Ferengi race, but it seems unlikely to me that the Ferengi would refuse to sell them a warp drive with a ridiculous markup, because that's kind of what the Ferengi do. So they would probably say, sure, you could have this fast ship if you give us your moon, or something like that. So maybe that's why they couldn't come to a deal, because the Ferengi wanted an outrageous price, but... That's my own little story there for that.
And then the other thing is, like, they're just a little simple, humble culture, and yet, like, that really terrible early 2000s, like, wide shot of their city, it looks relatively, you know, futuristic. I mean, it looks terrible. Like, the CG looks terrible, but, you know, you've got, like, the light rail coming in over the water, and you got the nice big shiny buildings and stuff, so they look, you know, sufficiently advanced to be able to figure a few things out, but... I guess the story wouldn't work if they had warp drive and they
could
were
just fly away,
capable of like figuring out what's wrong with themselves.
Yeah, there are a couple of the sense I got. Well, I think that the writers are putting this race in two parts that are kind of diametrically opposed, because the sense from one sense, looking at their planet and their ships and things, you feel like they're on the cusp of becoming a warp capable civilization because they seem fairly advanced. But then you find out that, oh, this isn't like a virus. It is a genetic disorder that they've had for thousands of years. And they've been struggling with it for that long, but they couldn't figure out it was a genetic disorder.
Yeah, apparently that's the one part of their advanced civilization that, like, they missed that part in the, like, scientific research, that genes are a thing.
Right. So that's struck me as hard to believe. And then, of course, there's another wrinkle to this in that they are not the only species of humanoids on their planet. They have I wouldn't say a subspecies, because I guess they're not related, but they're on the same planet. The unfortunately named Mank.
It's not a great name. Although I did think that there was at least some similarity between, like, you know, I guess they're where they came from, because, you know, they're exploring the Mank, who are apparently not affected by this genetic disease. Well, they don't know it's a genetic disease, because there's enough similarity that they could maybe use their immunity as the cure for themselves, which is great thinking, but they haven't been able to figure it out. So,
and I guess they draw the parallel between us and Neander. Is it Neanderthal or Neanderthal? I never know how to say it. So I guess we are related in that way. So I guess they're probably related in the distant past, and they just went in different directions.
They're much less advanced. They're doing more of the sort of terrible jobs that nobody wants to do, like cleaning bedpans or whatever. And they
live on reservations.
They live in designated areas that have land that cannot be cultivated. So the Valakians just sort of like give them the stuff they need, because don't worry, guys, we have better technology. We'll give you guys food and stuff. And that's sort of one way relationship could never go terribly wrong. But
no. Don't worry, your pretty little heads over this, Manx. Here you go.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, while Dr. Phlox and his little crew go take the blood samples from the Mank to try and do their own research, he notices that the Mank are very smart, and they catch on quickly, and he learned a couple English words. Well, I guess he at least learned the English word for food.
Right.
So
it's a good
they're growing, and they're learning, and he can sort blood samples. So that means that their culture is on the uprise, right, while the Valakians are on the downfall. And it's like, evolution and stuff, and, you know, survival of the fittest, and that's kind of what's going on here.
Yes, so once again, I found it weird. So they portray, well, A, I didn't realize they were different just like the dude was hanging out in the background, and they looked, he looked almost exactly like all the other people. So I didn't really realize they were different until they pointed out.
They really just did like the Neanderthal thing where they made like the forehead slightly larger with their weird little eye things.
Right. And so I was like, oh, he's speaking a different language, whatever. But so yeah, they say, okay, the Menk are underdeveloped. They are, you know, a couple of steps behind us in the old evolutionary chain here. And yet, your universal translator could immediately translate our language, which one imagines is much more complex than the Manc language, with two sentences to work from. And yet it refuses to translate the Manc language for some reason, which I found odd.
Because we needed to figure out that he's a different race.
Exactly. But yeah, I didn't understand why that the universal translator couldn't translate Mancanese.
At least nobody was insensitive enough to say, like, I can't tell the difference. You all look alike, even though you're different races.
That's right. What's the problem? You all look... this one only looks slightly different than you. You're all equally stupid. and so, yes, the big problem is that Dr. Phlox feels like he is in an ethical quandary because he doesn't know if they should be fiddling with the genetic... the evolutionary... road of this civilization, because it's clear that the Manc are evolving and the Valachians are not.
There are degrees of fiddling. Like, okay, so the sub commander basically says, like, look, they've already been fiddled with by warp capable society, so it's not really that big a deal. But then, like, they fiddle. Like, Dr. Phlox comes up with some medicine that'll, like, mm-hmm. put off their symptoms for, he says, 10 years. So maybe in that time they can come up with their own solution to their own problem, which is basically them saying, like, we know what's wrong with you. We just don't want to tell you. Maybe in the next 10 years you can figure it out for yourself and build your own warp drive in 10 years or something. But, like, you know, they fiddle, and it's just a degree to what degree do they fiddle? Like, does even, like, telling them that there's maybe a solution to this, is that fiddling in and of itself to let them know that, like, oh, there is actually a solution, but, you know, let them get to it on their own? Like, there are so many, like, blurry lines between what they do and what they don't do that it's – and especially the worst part, at least for me, is, like, getting back to the fact that the Valachians seem very capable of rational discourse. Like, maybe sit them down and go, like, guys – we can't just fix you because that would be weird, and we don't want to play God in large quotes because that's what the audience understands. But, like, say, like, hey, this seems to be tied to your genetics, and maybe lead them on the right path to figuring out what's wrong with themselves rather than just, like, here's some medicine, figure it out. Like, the line? You could sort of, like, have a conversation with them. They seem rational enough to, like, sit them down and go, here's sort of what's wrong with you, and then let them figure out the solution on their own. That would have been better, in my opinion, than just going, like, here's some medicine that'll make you feel okay for the next 10 years before you die.
Peace out. We gotta go.
Also, sorry we can't give you our spaceship because right.
It's where we keep our stuff.
We can't give you the plans, basically, because you're not familiar with antimatter and you'll basically just blow yourself up if you try and follow the plans.
And so that'll just make everything worse. I think that you've hit the nail right on the head about it seems weird that they're willing to go do a half measure, but they won't basically say, here's the cure, or they won't say, here's the problem. We can't tell you how to fix it, but here's the problem. At least you can figure it out yourself. You're smart enough. Maybe look at the Manc genetics and you can figure out, or maybe interbreed with the Mancs and you can save your civilization or something. I don't know. But figure it out. We'll leave. Maybe we'll come back in 10 years, and if you're all dead, you didn't figure it out.
We'll know what happened.
Yeah. Exactly.
But, like, you know, even with the warp drive stuff, go, like, well, maybe if you guys start studying this stuff a little bit more, that would help you guys out.
See, if I were in charge of the Valachian society, and it is unclear, the other weird thing I think about this is that, so the spaceship arrives, potentially it has the solution for their planet, but there's no government, I guess, so they just basically randomly pick a hospital and beam down to it and say, okay, we're going to fix your problem.
Well, it's the hospital that sick guy was previously in or something, because he ends up back there begging for the warp driver.
I thought that was weird. You think that there might be some kind of organization or something that they might want to talk to, and then they can help with that. I don't know. Yeah. And the other...
there's also the parallel of, you know, where the commander speaks to sub-commander and talks about how, well, maybe we can hang out here and sort of teach them until they get on their own 2 feet and mm-hmm. then go about it on their own. And she's like, well, that's what we decided at Vulcan, and we're still doing that on Earth, and it totally sucks, so we totally shouldn't do that.
For 90 years, and I'd like to not be there.
Yeah, but, like, that relationship seems to be working out okay, so I don't know, why not do it again?
We have this great new ship. We're helping solve people's problems.
Maybe there are some people on Earth who are willing to, like, hang out there and help them out. You don't know. Like, radio home and see, like, hey, does anybody want to hang out here on this, like, random planet and help these guys because they need some help.
Well, we know that there are because the doctor's pen pal is doing exactly that. Well, he's hanging out on an alien world just to learn about it. So he would certainly, you feel like there are other doctors who would be like, this is a fascinating problem. I want to go help.
You can get some grant money to help out, but it's basically like, they're like, this is as far as we can help you. And now we are going to leave and totally forget about you. And nobody else is ever going to come help you from our planet because... why? I don't know. Like,
let us never speak of this again.
Sure, right? Like, this is all you're going to get. I speak on behalf of everyone of Earth. We're never going to help you. Sorry, that's, guys.
Good luck. Also, your faces are stupid.
the whole point of this episode is to see, you know, where do you draw the line with medical science? And mm-hmm. just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And, you know, the ethics of technology and, you know, our responsibility in the things that we come up with and how we use them and, you know, all that fun goodness, which is nice. It's just about as subtle as a hammer.
Yes. And this episode also has a scene that I think perfectly illustrates the problem with prequels when you have this massive amount of canon behind it. And that was the scene I was describing where Archer's like, we have to cut. We don't have any rules now. We don't have any of these, like, you know, to tell me guiding principles to tell me what to do. Maybe when someone writes down some sort of directive, you're like, oh God, yes, the prime directive will come. We know. It's just, you know, fan service, but in an annoying way.
Does it show up in Enterprise or do they not bring it up at all?
I don't remember. They might eventually stumble upon the idea of the Prime Directive. But
Next episode should be Scott Bakula phoning home, petting his dog, which he brought for some reason, going like, hey, guys, we had this thing, and it would be super great if we had some rules out here. And here's why. Here's what happened.
We know what to do.
We had the physical embodiment of a thought experiment, and then we didn't know what to do, so we just used our best guess. You should write it on paper for us.
And that dog, Porthos, the dog is very cute, but it always bothered me that the captain just randomly brought his dog with him.
Seems rather irresponsible in the grand scheme of things.
It does. And also, he keeps feeding him cheese, and Porthos cannot digest cheese, and so that's also irresponsible.
It's like this guy doesn't know anything about dogs.
That's right.
But he can take him to the space doctor to have him fixed up.
Exactly, and everybody's happy. So, Dan, my question to you is, has this episode of Enterprise sparked a latent desire to see many more episodes of Star Trek? No.
I mean, it's not... Look, I enjoyed what I saw. Like, I'm interested in just sort of these overarching themes. Like, it's very, like, we pose a question, we wrap it up in one episode. So it's not like I feel like I'm missing out on the culmination of this particular story unless I watch the rest of the season or something. But it's certainly thought-provoking and interesting. It's just I am lazy and I don't watch that much TV. So this would have to fit into a very narrow slot in my life if I were to watch more Star Trek. But it's not that I would – look, if it was on TV, and I am a channel surfing horrible person who just, like, picks random crap to watch, if this was on TV, I would probably watch it.
Well, there you go. High praise.
High praise from a lazy person who barely has enough time to watch the movies he talks about every week on his other show.
Well, Dad, despite your limited interest in Star Trek, I thank you for overcoming that and being on.
I thank you for having me. This was fun.
Next on Random Trek, we return to the Delta Quadrant for Voyager Season 4, Episode 14, Message in a Bottle.